Welcome to another edition of Thinking Like a Lawyer.
How are you, Joe Patrice?
Good. Yes. I am good. But I was not prepared for you to try and...
I enjoy that I seem to have thrown you off your game.
Yeah.
That's a good time for me.
Nothing makes this seem more like a professional podcast than constantly trying to throw everybody off balance.
It makes you unhappy.
That is true.
A win is a win.
People describe log as a fast workplace environment. This actually feels on brand.
Yeah.
It's constantly getting cut off.
Yeah, I'm Joe Patrice from Above the Law. Yeah, and that was Chris Williams from Above the Law. And we've been interrupted before that by Catherine Rubino. We are here to talk about some of the big stories of the week in the legal universe, though first, as always, we begin with a little bit of a section of the show we like to call Small Talk.
Small Talk.
Okay. That sounded super evil. And with that, so today we're all kind of dealing with the fallout of some bank collapses. One that's getting more attention, we don't need to worry as much about, but one that's getting a little less attention is Signature. So how's that going? This is small talk, even though it's kind of legal related.
It's not at all small. It's just not a full segment, but it is absolutely related to our jobs, which is not small talk.
Medium talk.
Okay. Medium talk.
We've been partying like it's 1930s up in here with banks collapsing.
Okay.
It's been some good times. Obviously, Silicon Valley Bank collapsed on Friday. And on Sunday, regulators in New York took over Signature Bank, which, you know, is not a ginormous bank. You may not have heard of it, but, you know, it's a New York-based bank and does a lot of business with law firms, a lot of other professional services, some real estate, and, you know, a fairly traditional kind of mix of business, one might think.
Mm.
But you'd be correct up until about 2018, which is when Signature, in addition to sort of doing all this law firm work, started to get heavily involved in crypto.
Oh,
no.
Yeah, I did see that, you know, one of the things that I've been tracking on this is that obviously a lot of these bank three bank closures as of recording in a week that we're talking about, a lot of them have collapsed because the Dodd-Frank protections that were originally created were then loosened in 2018, largely at the lobbying work of Barney Frank himself, who at that point had become a board member of Signature Bank.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, he's certainly made some comments thinking that the regulators' takeover of Signature was a bit premature. There was a run on deposits on Friday, but the bank says at this point that they would have had it under control had they been allowed to open for business on Monday.
I mean, Sam Bankman-Fried says the same thing. So,
yeah. But the other kind of interesting part, particularly for those who are involved in the crypto industry, with Silvergate also sort of going under, Silvergate and Signature were the two primary 24/7 solutions for crypto businesses and exchange.
Aww.
So, yeah, it'll be an interesting time.
Yeah, you know, everybody keeps blaming crypto just because it's completely made up money that's driven largely by Ponzi schemes. And I don't know if that's fair.
Fake money has a way of being fake.
Yeah.
Like, that's the subheading to this.
That's the corny reason for blaming crypto. I blame crypto because it's fun to say. Mm. Like, you know, the dollar, boring. Crypto's mysterious, you know, and it makes tech bros angry.
Mysterious is really what you want in a financial instrument, though.
Nothing says secure trade like, I don't know how much this is worth.
So speaking of how much things are worth, also a quick shout out to the lawyers somewhere in the world who are getting paid for closing arguably the most significant dollar and 20 cent deal in history, the UK SVB holdings could have become a big problem, but HSBC has stepped in and bought all of SVB UK for £1. Some lawyers were up all night inking a deal to allow them to take over.
Billing a lot more than a dollar.
One would assume billing more than a dollar 20 at current exchange rates. So congrats to them. So yeah, so is that good for our small talk segment? I think it probably is. Well, no, it's not medium. Small talk. It's medium
definitely
talk.
Medium talk.
Yeah, medium talk. That's our sound.
Different sound for it.
Well, that's why I played the party horn. I thought that that was our medium talk
I like
sound.
It.
I respect that.
Yeah, you know. All right, so let's get to the important news of the day. What's going on? Thanks for keeping
I'm
up.
I'm pretty sure it was your story, Joe.
That's true. I thought
so
you
I thought
would
you might
want
to introduce it.
And I
See,
thought you might invite me to do it.
Read the pre-show memo. It's that you've fallen down on the job.
You are such a you're the opposite of a generous improv partner.
This is the revenge of small talk here. You saw that little segment felt like the personal interaction. I like it.
Just yeah.
You know who I don't like?
Who?
Judge Duncan.
Oh, there we go. All right. Thanks for a segue. So yeah, so we have.
I know you need help.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. So this is the most recent episode in the ongoing cancel culture crisis, as it is being disingenuously billed throughout the law school world. This time, it is not at Yale. Finally, we don't talk about Yale. This is at Stanford. Judge Duncan, who's, you know, probably most, he's involved in a lot of retrograde opinions, but most famously for going out of his way to explain why misgendering people is his role, and that he, as a matter of law, feels that they must be misgendered. This violated his own circuit's rules, by the way, but he did it anyway.
That's a hot take.
Yeah, it made him something of a little bit of a minor celebrity among
right-wing. Well, he's trying to increase that, isn't he?
Among kind of the right-wing powers that be that choose who gets promoted down the road. He does seem to have seemingly decided he'd fallen behind in that and needed a Q boost and decided to go.
He wanted some headlines, and he's got them.
Yeah, so he went to Stanford for an event. There was a protest, as one might expect from somebody like that going to Stanford. Then, so he's managed to get Stanford, the school, to apologize to him in a letter.
So what did he do that Stanford had felt that they had to apologize?
Well, I mean, there were protesters, right? And you know, the usual procedure of claiming that he was shouted down by these law students acting outrageous behavior where they're not acting like real law students who would understand and civilly debate things. You know, the usual talking points. Unfortunately, the extra layer to this is that, you know, say what you will about the Alliance Defending Freedom, who's been kind of driving a lot of these events, the recognized hate group who keeps going to law school campuses, having a protest, and then claiming, oh, look at all these horrible law students. Judge Duncan took it a new direction and a new direction that kind of, I mean, I would have thought would not have helped him out, but it potentially opens a new chapter in this ongoing discussion, because he rolled in and rather than really strive to maintain that moral high ground of, yeah, you don't like me, but I will engage you and I'll listen to your questions and answer and we'll have civil discourse. The problem for him is that these students decided to do that. There were obviously protests and signs and so on, and less than civil comments at various points throughout the event. But what ended up happening is several people started asking him actual pointed questions about how he would defend certain decisions that he made.
How'd he take that?
He did not deal well. He did not like the idea that he might have to actually answer a question, which historically has been kind of the moral high ground that you needed to make this whole thing work. It's kind of the conceit of the whole thing is the debate me conceit that these people use, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, these sorts of speakers want to paint themselves as the only adult in the room, and that falls apart when you're acting like a toddler.
Yeah, the victimhood game is problematic when you start yelling at the in students' faces that they're appalling idiots. He dismissed a woman telling a story of how she had been raped with nice story. He claims in an update to that that he didn't say that, that what he'd really said is that's a story, not a question. Whether or
Which
not
is better somehow
query whether or not that's better in any way, but that is his defense of what he actually had said there.
He said T question.
Yeah, basically. It's more of a comment than a question. It was kind of his take. But still, yeah, he's active. He was asked about in particular about that misgendering opinion and asked how he squares that opinion with other canons of legal practice that you're supposed to treat people with respect. Why is it that like this situation does not deserve the respect of that? His response to that was just read the opinion. For the reasons in the opinion, all right? That's not really engaging in civil discourse. He was also asked about some voting rights cases, I believe it was. He said, well, which case? Cite the case. And when the student didn't have it off the top of his head, he apparently berated them that you think you could get away with this in court not knowing? Then the student... because
This is not court, first of all.
It's not court. And because the internet is amazing, the student then found the site and said, this one. And he said, was I even on the panel of that one? And my question is, does he think that would work in court to not even know whether what his job is? Yeah. And then he blew off that question too. Yeah. The whole thing kind of became an episode where, you know, be careful what you wish for. The conceit of all this is wish to have a open debate where people ask you questions. And then when they did, he was not ready.
Yeah. I think this wildly backfired on Judge Duncan. I mean, even I think folks who are predisposed to say things like, oh, these protests have gotten out of hand, this is a problem. Yeah. But even those folks are saying, as bad as you might think students protesting someone on campus is, this behavior is worse.
Well, but that's kind of I hear that, but there are definitely some voices that are generally critical of students that are saying that. However, the part that I think is a little more scary is that it has seemingly worked. The usual folks, the Free Beacon and Ed Whalen and all the like usual, and Jonathan Turley, your usual kind of clown car folks who trump up these issues, reference totally intended, I guess there, they are not wavering. They're like, one would think if this was really a backfire, they would try to downplay this one as much as possible, but they're leaning into it too. They're very much recharacterizing this as he did nothing wrong and it's all the students. And there's some disingenuously edited together video clips that make it seem like they were all out to get him. There are more full clips that some folks, I know Jay Willis of Balls and Strikes, have put up that show that this is not the way it went down.
This is the edited version.
Right. So we've got some...
Yeah, and I think we kind of made this point when we were talking about James Ho, another federal judge, very much to the right. When we were talking about him, I think that there's a rush to get the most headlines, to appear the most... Obviously, you know, despite any legal methods... just going to give the political results that the far right wants. And that's how they get promoted.
It is resume via trolling. But but here's the thing.
Great
about...
Great line.
Here's the thing about Judge Ho's situation, though, where Judge Ho parachuted himself into the Yale situation that didn't involve him and started making claims that he was going to boycott them. That's how he kind of got his attention there. But the thing with Ho is he's a lot more clever. I mean, he held on to that moral high ground. He leaned into the idea that I'm serious, and you're not. Yeah, they could have just let... I mean, part of that is the benefit, brilliantly on his part, of he wasn't part of this protest, right? He was on the outside talking about it after the fact. He didn't have to have the moment where somebody asked him a pointed question and he didn't have an answer. This is where Duncan seems to have miscalculated, but or maybe not. I mean, if they're letting it happen.
But even though his name might be on the top of some lists, I do think that this kind of an incident and the backlash that is coming from some corners affects your ability to be reconfirmed by the Senate to a higher job.
Perhaps. I don't know. Like it, I view that we are kind of in a zero, you know, in a moment of seeing zero gravity to see where this goes. If the narrative ends up leaning more towards the way in which Zillow Ed, as we all call him, because he's the one who tried to...
That's a decently old reference. I appreciate it, though.
Yeah, that's the one where Ed Whalen tried to prove that Kavanaugh could not have possibly engaged in an attempted assault because he's looked at the floor plans on Zillow and it just doesn't add up. But yeah, if that narrative holds, then, you know, maybe you can get away with this. And I kind of characterize it very much as like a wrestling heel situation. Like he rolled in like Ric Flair. You all hate me because I'm so pretty. And then got the crowd that way.
I hear what you're saying, but fundamentally, you're going to need moderate Republicans at a minimum in order to pull off the next level.
Maybe, yeah. I don't know.
It'll be interesting to see. You know, this just happened fairly recently, to see what the longer term blowback is.
I mean, I do think that he is more of a long shot than somebody like Ho anyway.
I think that's true.
And so ultimately, I guess, maybe you're right. I don't think this gets him ahead of Ho in Leonard Leo's book of wish lists. Generate quality briefs, memos, and redlines in minutes with Callidus AI. You enter the case's facts, then Callidus suggests bodies of law, statutes, and precedents. You tell it if those are relevant, and Callidus generates a well-cited, well-formatted document. You can trust what went into it because you put it there. Be exceptionally productive with better outcomes using Legal's most advanced AI platform. Just 3 minutes from registration to results. Get $90 off your first 2 months. Use promo code Joe at CallidusAI.com. That's CallidusAI.com.
Hey, Gee, what's up?
Just having some lunch, Conrad.
Hey, Gee, do you see that billboard out there?
Oh, you mean that guy out there in the gray suit?
Yeah, the gray suit guy.
Order up.
There's all those beautiful, rich, leather-bound books in the background.
That is exactly the one. That's J.D. McGuffin at law. He'll fight for you!
I bet you he has got so many years of experience.
Like decades and decades. And I bet, Gee, I bet he even went to a law school.
Are you a lawyer? Do you suffer from dull marketing and a lack of positioning in a crowded legal marketplace? Sit down with Gee and Conrad for Lunch Hour Legal Marketing on the Legal Talk Network, available wherever podcasts are found.
All right, we're back. For anybody who's interested, Elon Musk continues to screw everything up on a legal, if not business level. But he's had another run-in with...
We should clarify. Are you talking about the killing monkeys with the Neuralink stuff?
Oh, no, we already knew he was killing monkeys with Neuralink. No,
are you talking about Tesla losing like hundreds of millions of dollars worth of stock?
You know, no, actually, I think we already knew about that one. He did something else that got him into hot water last week. I don't quite remember what it was.
Oh, I think he did an ableism.
Well, yeah.
He did an ableism. There you go. There you go.
Fair enough. Or for those of you who are more legally inclined, anti-discrimination law tends to say that you don't publicly mock employees for having
ADA violations
having about muscular dystrophy, but you know, yeah. Elon is an iconoclast who...
Elon's yeah. Elon, you guys.
Yeah. I mean, Musk's.
He's playing 12-dimensional chess here, friends. This is all part of the plan. Yeah, so tell us a little bit about how this went down.
Yeah, well, man-child billionaire Elon Musk, after being contacted by an indeterminate, unknown at the time, employee, contacted Musk directly because after 9 days of him reaching out to HR... HR never got back to him. He says, "Hey, do I work for you?" And then Elon decides that this is a good time to show his fans how cultured he is. So I think he has like some clip from like some office comedy, you know, the type of stuff you'd expect.
Yeah.
People who have bad Elden Ring builds to find humorous, you know. What I'm saying is his humor never progressed past 1993. Anyway, so adding towards that, South Park X humor, he then mocks the guy for being for having muscular dystrophy. He's like, this guy does no work. Over time, you then find out not only does this guy do a lot of work for Twitter, he's also like the like one of the best people in the world, like voted for like three times. Not only does he do a lot of work at Twitter, he does a lot of work everywhere else, and he has muscular dystrophy. So he's harder working than for everyone else, which you can't make fun of for people like Twitter, by the way. So like,
so he also, yeah. So there's definitely that. There's also kind of importantly, he had an employment agreement that includes a $100 million termination clause.
Here's the thing. So the guy named Holly, since he has like tact and common sense, he never explicitly said, run me what you owe me, motherfucker. But he was very, he did it in like the ways you would expect an adult to do. Like, am I allowed to talk about this? Is this permission to disclose? Here's what I do, blah, blah, blah. The thing we had talked about, is that still in play? And then the bumbling car monkey guy is like, ooh, what are you talking about? I'm smart. He committed the workplace lawsuit equivalent of dumping over a huge truck of ramen noodles and everybody just like rubbernecking at the crash, because it's so beautiful to see in real time. It's like, oh, he's actively losing money.
Yeah. Well, also because he's, you know, a man child who needs all the attention all the time. We saw it all because he's forced his tweets onto everyone's feed. So even when he fucks up, everybody knows.
Once he's like, oh no, what is that on the fan blades? Is that shit? Did the shit hit the fan? And then he goes back and deletes tweets where there was one tweet. He was like, this guy is literally the worst person in the world. All the people who he knows hates him because he had a popularity poll was like, should I still run Twitter? And everyone said, no, they take screenshots. So he can't clean up the mess he makes once he tries to make it.
It does raise the question, though, like, what's going on with his legal counsel here?
He's fired them all, no?
I mean, there's been a lot of folks fired, but
this is what happens when you fire all the lawyers.
Yeah. If the conditions counselor look anything like what any other people that work for him look like, if they say anything to him either publicly or privately about the bullshit he's shitting about, they get fired.
But you don't need to question his like feelings to say, you can feel however you want, sir. You will owe $100 million if this happens. How do we feel about that? that's the sort of advice that I think you could give pretty easily.
The fun part was that the suspected contract breach, he would pay the guy $100 million because the company that he'd had was bought up by Twitter, right?
Right.
Then on top of that, out of speculation, oh shit, maybe instead of playing 4D checkers, Elon is playing chess with checkers pieces. Tesla's stock then plummeted. And then it's like, oh, wait, this isn't even the first time. There were four other people on Do Not Fire list that got fired. And I'm like, how?
He thought it was the to-be-fired list. Yeah, it was a simple reading comprehension issue there.
It's bad, but it really does. In a serious angle on this, I do think there's something to be said for how do you manage a client, even whether you're in-house or not. And if you have a client who is prone to firing people for questioning him, you know, maybe you pick your battles. You don't necessarily give him the primer on how discrimination law works, but you know,
yeah,
you point
out
the contract.
Yeah, of course you can fire him. It's going to cost you $100 million.
You do something because you kind of have an obligation to try. But I mean, the problem is this is how all of this has already happened, right? Like fundamentally, the reason this guy even owns Twitter is because he told Skadden to stop asking for a due diligence protection in the agreement. And they ultimately acquiesced to that. And then when he decided he wanted out, he had already waived the only way he could get out. Like, it's the customer is always right, but also a moron. And at a certain point, where do you as a lawyer draw the line between doing what the client asks and protecting the client from themselves, you know?
Very glad I'm not Elon Musk's lawyer, though.
I was about to say, thankfully, that's not for me to figure out. I just get to call the guy stupid, which I think is the proper position to be in. You know,
that's fair. That's right. That's fair.
But that's just me thinking like a lawyer.
Oh, Wow. So naming the show. Well done.
You get it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. The other thing that happened this week is our former host, Ellie Mistal, back when I didn't get interrupted all the time.
This is so much better.
I agree.
Also, anybody who listens to an archival episode will know that that's not true at all. I got interrupted constantly then. But Ellie Mistal wrote a piece in The Nation where he talked about, he really blasted Merrick Garland for having not put Trump under indictment earlier. It is not particularly clear for what, and by that I mean, obviously, he meant for various January 6th actions, but it wasn't very particularly clear what statute he thought would have supported an indictment based on the evidence that at that point was undeveloped. I responded with an article about how you can't really blame Merrick Garland for that, because that's just not how the criminal justice system operates. If the various statutes that one could charge Trump under, if you were to do that, you would have to either cross lines into what incitement means that would be particularly troubling, or you would have to have rolled in with half-proven claims and hoped that the evidence would miraculously appear before the trial, or else you'd end up with, you know, giving Trump a double jeopardy protection from ever going after him.
Yeah, I mean, so. I think two things. First of all, as tempting as I think incitement is, and I think that what Trump did was obviously a lot closer, but I think that anything that extends what incitement is just more likely to be used against BLM protesters, other protesters, anytime there's even, you know, two pennies worth of property damage. Well,
we already saw this. Yeah. This already went to the Supreme Court. They tried to go after DeRay for speaking at an event, and then later one person at the event threw a brick, and they tried to put him in prison for that. Right. And even this Supreme Court thought that was insane.
Right. But I'm saying if we extend it to this case without more evidence, particularly at the time that what we knew then, I think that would have been particularly problematic. I think the other point is that it underplays how valuable an acquittal would have been for Trump. Yeah. If you didn't have all your ducks in a row, if you don't have a slam dunk for sure conviction, I think that Donald Trump getting to get up and scream about how he's been acquitted and how that proves that he's innocent is infinitely more dangerous than not going after him.
I mean, that's the Omar line, right? Like, if you come at the king, you can't be missing here. Like, that's the whole point.
It was probably cooler when Omar said it, but I get you.
Right. Like, I mean, I was trying to inject a little bit of pop culture cool into this show.
I respect the effort.
Question mark.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Yeah. But anyway, yeah. But this was the back and forth we got. And I'm, you know, and Ellie has a lot of fervent fans who have been sending me a lot of very mean mail about me questioning whether or not you could have just kind of magicked Trump into prison.
And I think that magicking it is the right way also to frame it, because it'd be great. I understand the impulse to say, you know, kind of in a, I know it when I see it. I don't know the statute, but I know that shit ain't good. I feel that. I viscerally feel that. But I don't think that that is what lawyers, one, but certainly most specifically the attorney general, should be doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a tension between the colloquial use of incitement, because, like, there's no question there. Mm-hmm. But, like, thinking about things legally, it really is like, well, what exactly happened here? Because I agree with Joe. I'm like, however incitement gets stretched here, in this case, how will this affect people protesting pipelines? You know, how will this affect people trying to draw attention to rapidly approaching climate crisis? And it'll be great for, like, what is it, like, contextual irony. Like, I think about that there were a bunch of laws that were passed that were meant to, like, net Black Lives Matter protesters that ended up getting used against Trump supporters. Like, that happens back and forth. But, like, yeah, it's like writing with a scalpel. You know, you have to be very particular with how you cut and dice up what these words mean in legal context.
And it kind of felt like a lot of the, oh, we should put him in jail for XYZ. I would try to link that up with a statute that already exists. And I was like, but if these are the elements, you don't have that, you know? Mm. Anyway.
Would be nice, though.
Yeah. And there's a reason why, you know, like it. There's a reason why mob bosses don't go to jail immediately, right? Like, at a certain point.
At least not after 2 years.
They go to jail for tax evasion, right?
Well, I mean, there's certainly that, too.
But it's not there's some also tax issue with Trump or anything.
Yeah. But that's the issue. Like, those kind of financial crimes and this classified documents case, like, are much more concrete issues. But they aren't ones that Ellie was really talking about, because he's more talking about his whole goal is that there should have been something that could have triggered the 14th Amendment's bar on somebody holding public office down the road. Like with a mob boss, they don't go to jail instantly either, because the whole design of the system is they don't do any actual
crime,
right?
They don't do the thing.
Like, somebody else does, and then over time you get up the chain and find out they were ordered to do that thing. But you don't, you can't just jump right to it. And yes, we all know, but that's not enough. Anyway. So that's been that this week. Any other last items before we begin our farewell? I have one.
I just wanted to say, and this relates to this. It was a billboard I've seen, and by that I mean it's probably saw it online. It's important to keep in mind in these contexts. It was this lawyer advertising his services, and he said, "Just because you did it does not mean you're guilty."
Nice. Fair enough. So our one announcement is we aren't going to be able to have a show next week. Just the hecticness of legal week and everything is going to force that off. So we will see you in 2 weeks, everybody. Probably talk about legal week and everything when that happens.
Stay tuned for the very exciting legal technology updates.
That was good.
They are exciting.
Fuck the updates. That was some good voice. I was like, what outro to anime was this? That was good. Have you considered doing radio?
Subscribe to the show so that you get new episodes when they come out. Give us reviews, stars, write something. It always helps more people find the show. You should listen to other shows like Catherine's has the Jabot. I'm on the Legal Tech Week Journalist Roundtable. You should be listening to the other offerings of the Legal Talk Network. You should follow us on social media. Elon's pet home is where a lot of us are. The blog is at ATL Blog. I'm at Joseph Treese. She's at Catherine One, as in the numeral one there. Chris is at Rights for Rent. Yes. Oh, yeah. Good point. Yeah, that has become an issue. So Rights, as in he's writing. Okay. Anyway.
It's meant to be clever.
Yeah, it is. You should be reading Above the Law so you see these stories and others before we chat about them here. And with all that, we will check in with you in a bit.
Peace.
Peace.
If you're a lawyer running a solo or small firm and you're looking for other lawyers to talk through issues you're currently facing in your practice, join the Unbillable Hours Community Roundtable, a free virtual event on the third Thursday of every month. Lawyers from all over the country come together and meet with me, lawyer and law firm management consultant Christopher T. Anderson, to discuss best practices on topics such as marketing, client acquisition, hiring and firing, and time management. The conversation is free to join, but requires a simple reservation. The link to RSVP can be found on the Unbillable Hour page at LegalTalkNetwork.com. We'll see you there.